ॐ भद्रं कर्णेभिश्शृणुयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः त्यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः Divyo himurtav purushaha, divyo himurtav purushaha, sabahya bhyantaro hyajaha, sabahya bhyantaro hyajaha, aprano himana shubraha, aprano himana shubraha, yaksharat paratav paraha, aksharat paratav paraha. Sunday again. Divyaha hi amurtaha purushaha sabahya abhyantaraha hyajaha apranaha yamanaha shubraha hi aksharat paratha paraha. Okay. We have a quarter left of this verse. It's the last pada that we have to do, just to kind of remind you. The previous verse was talking about the whole creation, all of the living beings, all of the living jivas, coming from the one self, just like all of the sparks come from the one fire. Like that, all of the living jivas come from or sustained by and go back into that one Atma, the Purusha, the Atma. And so then you might think that the Atma or the Self, Brahman, goes through some sort of modification to become all of these sparks. And just think about it, even if you're thinking about the clay moves and is molded, right, is molded to become the pot. It stays as the clay, but it's molded to become the pot. So that way you could think, well, the fire is something active. The fire is active and it's producing flames. Even though the sparks are all of this, they're all the same. They're all nothing but fire, but still the flame is something with the fire is something active producing the sparks. So in that way is the Atma, is Brahman, is the Self. Something which is active, producing, becoming, going through a process of transformation to become this creation, even though in reality the only substance that is there is the Atma, has the Self, which is Brahman, gone through some sort of modification of any sort, right, to become this creation. So what is the relationship between the Atma, the Purusha, the akshara, that which is immutable, that which is changeless, that which doesn't diminish or change in any way, really. But what is the relationship of that to this creation for which it is the source, for which it is the very being? So that you don't get the idea that the Atma or the Purusha goes through any type of modification, this verse. Okay, so this is it's really an important verse. It says, just to review quickly, Divyaha, the Purusha, first of all, Purusha. Purusha is the name for the Atma, for Brahman. It means Purna, that which is infinite, limitless, that is residing in the body. In other words, from the standpoint of you as a jiva, you recognize that conscious being as your own self within this body, when you recognize the nature of yourself, in the end, you recognize that, I'm not contained by this body, right? But initially, to find the Purusha, you find the Purusha in this body as I'm a conscious being. Then you find out that that Purusha, that Atma, is Purna, is limitless. It's Divyaha, it's Chaitanya, it's consciousness, right? Self-evident consciousness. It's Amurtaha, it's something that has no form. It's not contained by anything. It's formless like space. Right? So it's consciousness, it's Amurta, it's free from form. It's Purnaha, absolutely full. It's Abhyantara and Bahyantara. It's Bahya and Abhyantara. Bahya means it's outside and it's inside. So in reference to this physical body, when you think Purusha, the one, the conscious being who's abiding within, no, it's neither within nor without, right? Or it's both within and without. Because as we went through this last week, consciousness initially, when it's identified with the body or with the mind, it seems to be within. But once that drisha, seer-seeing differentiation is done, then the line of subjectivity changes. And instead of there being an outside and an inside, everything is outside. Initially, everything is outside. In a sense, now this physical, the universe external to the body is outside of my body. But then the body also is known. So it's outside. The sense organs are known. So they're outside, means objectified by me. My thoughts are known. They're outside, therefore, as objects. They're known. My moods and my emotions, they're outside because they're known. The ahankar, the I notion, they're outside because known. And then, so everything that I had considered to be inside is outside. And but then again, if I look at it, well, all these things that I'm saying are outside, actually they're contained in my awareness. None of them are away from my awareness. So this inside-outside falls apart. So the Atma, Purusha, the one who is Purnaha, is pure consciousness, has no form. Consciousness has no form. Right? Because all of the forms are outside. All of the forms are objectified. Right? So consciousness itself has no forms. It's a Murtaha. It's Ajaha. Because it's not objectifiable, it doesn't exist within time and space, it's not born. If it's not born, because you have to be within time, you have to be an object to be born, you have to be circumscribed. So if you're not born, then you don't die either, because you've never come into being. How can you go out of being? Right? And if you don't come into being, you can't go through a process of change because you're free from time. Right? So being formless, being consciousness, being non-objectifiable, being free from form, being unborn, then also you're apranaha and amanaha. You're not breathing and you're not thinking. The pranas are the vital force. The body has the vital force. This is a beautiful meditation also. When you recognize, this is actually a beautiful differentiation you can make. When you're meditating, just become aware of your body, relax, become aware of your body, and then you become aware of the breath. And you just let the body breathe. And you just sit there. You relax. You sit there watching, aware of the incoming and outcoming breath. So the body is breathing. The breath is taking place. You're not breathing. Consciousness is not breathing. The breath is breathing. The body is breathing. The lungs are breathing. The breathing is something that is taking place in your awareness. So it's a beautiful differentiation. To recognize that the conscious being in which breath is taking place is not itself breathing. Right? Otherwise you couldn't be aware of the ingoing and outgoing breath and being aware of the held breath also. You're also not thinking. If you had a mind, if the consciousness was a mind, thinking mind, then it would be thinking as thoughts are going on. But instead the consciousness is the very being in which thoughts take place. Itself is not thinking. The thoughts are coming and going. You're present. You are present to the thoughts. You're the consciousness that illumines the thoughts. You're not thinking. The mind is thinking. Okay? If consciousness was thinking, you wouldn't be able to differentiate the conscious presence, the awareness, from the thoughts. If you can differentiate the awareness from the thoughts, the awareness itself isn't thinking. The thoughts are thinking. The awareness is illumining the thoughts. So, amanaha. So, understanding that, when you are doing this differentiation, your being, the conscious being that you are, is still, it's changeless. But amidst this changelessness, or with this changelessness, comes all of this that is changing. And so, there's two realities that have to be dealt with here. There's the reality of that which is changeless, and the reality of that which is changing. Okay. And so, this is in this Upanishad, in this last quarter, it brings out these two realities. Both are called satyam. The reality of that which is changeless, the purusha, right? That which is absolutely full and complete, that which is amurta, that which has no form, which is pure consciousness, which is unborn, which is changeless. That reality is called paramarthika satyam. That's absolute reality, because it never comes and goes. It never wavers. You can't get rid of it, right? The other reality is called vyavaharika satyam. That's called empirical reality. And that's the reality which is the projection of this whole creation through maya. That's the what we call the maya upadhi. So two realities, the paramarthika satyam, the absolute reality, and the vyavaharika satyam, the empirical reality. Why do we even call it reality? Because it enjoys an objectivity which is shared. That's why it gets this name satyam, vyavaharika satyam, empirical reality. It enjoys a shared experience. It's like all of us here are enjoyed the shared experience of being here in this class, in this room. We're experiencing this world through our sense organs. And there's a certain agreement, there's a certain laws that we're all existing in, which we ourselves as individuals have not created. That's the shared empirical reality that we say is the projection of maya. The thing is, we have to see, and what the Upanishad wants to show us here in this verse, what is the relationship between this empirical reality that we experience and the paramarthika satyam of Brahman, of the conscious being, which in fact is my nature. So what is the relationship between the absolute reality and the empirical reality? The absolute reality is called Brahman, right? That which is infinite, sat-chit ananda. The empirical reality is called mitya, which has as its cause maya. Okay? So then the question is, though, what is the relationship between Brahman and this Brahman becoming this creation? If we said, this is the whole thing. If there is only paramarthika satyam, Brahman, then Brahman somehow molds itself into this creation, but then Brahman is continually changing. So that would mean there was no paramarthika satyam. So if Brahman is complete, is continually coming and going, then paramarthika satyam goes away. If paramarthika satyam, absolute reality, it means that which is, period. It doesn't come and go. It doesn't change in any way. Paramarthika satyam, that Brahman can't change to become this. But then here is this, which is changing all of the time, which enjoys an empirical reality. What is that? What is that reality? What causes it? What is the relationship of this reality to the paramarthika satyam, the absolute reality? So here what he says, to kind of move into this discussion, he says, aksharat paritaha paraha. He says, from the akshara, which is supreme. So this is very terse. The word akshara means that which you can't change, what you can't get rid of. There are two aksharas. The one akshara of Paramarthika Satyam, which is my, is the conscious being which I am. The other akshara is maya. Okay, so now, let me explain this. Maya is that which projects as the whole infinite creation. But it projects cyclically. It projects, it's sustained, and it resolves. It projects, it's sustained, and resolves. When it resolves into a causal condition from which it comes again, projects again. That causal condition never leaves. You can't get rid of it. It's beginningless. Right? So Maya is as beginning. Brahman is timeless. Paramarthika Satyam, consciousness, is timeless. Maya is beginningless. Because the causal condition, right, you can't ever, it will never go. Causal condition will never go. That's why the creation is continually, is cyclical, right? It's cyclical, beginninglessly cyclical. And so that akshara is supreme, is paraha, is causal. The akshara maya is causal to what? The projection of the creation. Let me give you, just to understand, an example of it. If I ask you right now to, you know, close your eyes and think of your home, an image of your home, the front of your home. You can close your eyes and you can think of that image, right? Now, you can hold that image and then you can pull that image back. Stop thinking about it, right? So you project the image, you hold the image, and you pull the image back. Everybody see that? The image is in causal condition initially because I don't think you were thinking of having a vision of your house until I mentioned it, right? So it's in causal condition. It's there as part of your knowledge base, but it's not manifest. When I ask you to manifest it, then you do. And you hold it, and it's there. And then I say, okay, pull it back in. Think of something else. And it goes back into causal condition. So now that causal condition is paraha. It's supreme. It's higher than the manifestation. See what I mean? So the maya itself, which is the causal condition, is higher in the sense of being causal to the manifestation. So now, look at it in terms of the Ishvara. This creation is said to come from Maya, which is the causal condition of the creation. That's what we call Maya. It's the causal condition from which the entire universe projects. When the universe projects, we call that Maya too, but we actually have different names for it. When the whole universe projects, we say the whole physical creation is called Virat. We say the subtle creation is called Hiranyagarbha. Virat is like the physical manifestation of Ishvara. Hiranyagarbha is like the subtle manifestation of Ishvara. Ishvara is Brahman with this Maya, with the Maya Upadhi. The Maya Upadhi is in causal condition. What is contained in that causal condition? All knowledge. All knowledge in unmanifest condition. That's what it is. What happens when all knowledge manifests? We have the creation, right? You see that? Now, think of, just because I want you to kind of understand this experientially so we can actually see what they're, so that you can understand the internal experience of this. Right now, in causal condition for you, your mind, so much of your knowledge is in causal condition, right? It's there, but it's not manifest. That's what we mean by causal condition. It is there, but it's not manifest. Not manifest means it's not being experienced. But it's still there. And so I can say all kinds of things to you to make different parts of that manifest, like apple, tree, clouds, meadow. Just say all of these words and manifestation comes as I say the word. Right? So that means that all of this knowledge is lying there in the unconscious, if we want to say for the mind, Or we can just say, if we're using these Vedantic terms, flying there in causal condition. So now, imagine this. The entire infinite creation that is now is like manifest knowledge. Just like if I asked you to think of a knowledge, think of an apple. That's manifest knowledge. Okay? Think of this creation as manifest knowledge. From the standpoint of Ishwara, from Brahman, as pure consciousness, there's this what we call the Kalpita Maya Upadhi. Means Kalpita Upadhi? Means that Maya as a Kalpita Upadhi means it's a conditioning agent which has no being or substance apart from the self. That's the nature of Maya. How can you understand the stuff of Maya? Is only to understand the little piece of Maya that you have. Right? You have Maya too. You have Maya as a creative capacity. It's just you have that Maya. You have you have Brahman. You have the self that you are. And then with this Jiva Upadhi, which is part of the entire creation, you also have Maya. Maya is not slipping away from you. And so, for you can understand what Ishwara is on an infinite level, you can understand on what we call an limited level. So Ishwara, it's limitless. Limitless knowledge. For you, it's limited knowledge. But limited knowledge, yes, but the Maya relationship is the same. Right? Understanding from unmanifest to unmanifest is the same. Understanding the changelessness of your being before, during, and after the manifestation of anything, that also is the same in reference to your mind. Step, are you following me? This is so critically important to what's being said here. So just sticking with your mind for a moment. If you think of yourself right now, just the conscious being that you are, your own presence, when we do these meditations where you relax your body and then you watch the thoughts pass through your mind, right? Just relax your body, let yourself become aware of your body, aware of your sense organs, aware of your mind, and then you just relax and watch the thoughts come and go. When you're in the middle of this experience, there's two things that are there. There's your own presence, right? Just the awareful being that you are. And then there's the passing through of thoughts. One thought after another. That's the experience. So there's the subject, which is the Purusha, right? The subject is the Divyaha, the Amurtaha. The subject there is the consciousness, which is not a form. The forms are the things that are being illumined. Right? Forms are the things that you're aware of. Not the awareness. The awareness isn't a form. If the awareness was a form, who's aware of it? So awareness isn't a form. Awareness is awareness. Right? And it's a murta, it's formless. Right? And it's the very, it's Purnaha. By Purnaha means it's completely full. You can't, what are you going to add to awareness? And they say Purnaha, really, if you think of it, the conscious being that you are, is it incomplete? If it's incomplete, then you have to be able to add something to it. And what are you going to add? It has no boundaries. Your being, just pure awareness, the conscious being that you are, it has no boundaries. It's got no containers to pour anything into it. You know, it is whole and complete as it is. And so this changeless being that I am, right, has as a capacity is what we call Maya. Now the thing is, this Maya that we experience, because here are all of these changing thoughts, I can also quieten the mind can become quiet, and now the same changeless self is illumining this very quiet, absorbed mind. And that mind can be thinking again, it can be imagined, it can do all kinds of things. But no matter what it is doing, the being that it enjoys, The consciousness that it enjoys is absolutely changeless. And that's my direct, immediate experience. I can, in fact, never change that. Because changeless is changeless. You can't make something changeless change. You can't make something which is non-objectifiable modify. And so once you recognize kind of the sanctity of your own being, by sanctity, that means there's nothing you can do about it. Right? You can't sully it. You can't hurt it. You can't cover it. There's nothing that you can do. It is always present in exactly the same way. Now, there's also this other factor. So there's awareness here that is changeless, and there's this other factor that we call Maya, right, that is always known. It is always there in terms of the mind, either absorbed, so that now you have awareness, illumining, a mind that is absorbed into the awareness itself, so it has no, it's not adding anything in terms of perception, or there it's just in its own unmanifest condition, right? Or it's manifesting. So in terms of your experience, it's manifesting in terms of thoughts, right? And what are the thoughts? Manifest knowledge, right? The manifestation of knowledge. The manifestation, let's put it this way, your mind manifests, it's the manifestation of what can be manifest. Right? So what there is to be manifest, it is the manifestation of what is there to be manifest. And so say now, if you take that on an infinite level, what is this creation? It's that same awareness with that total Maya of which all of us are a part. Right? And so then this creation is a manifestation of total knowledge. And what would that mean? If I say for you, you manifest right now an apple in your mind, or manifest a meadow, right? Or manifest an image of your home. When you have that manifestation, that entire manifestation is only consciousness with name and form. I want you to recognize that experientially. Like if I say right now, imagine a meadow. And so you imagine a meadow. Now if I say, that meadow that you've just imagined is only consciousness. What do I mean? I mean that there's names and forms and colors that make up the meadow, but there's really nothing there but consciousness. Consciousness is the very stuff of the imagination. There's nothing else there. It's not like there's an imagination and then consciousness over here, or that the imagination has some being away from consciousness. Right? So in fact, the only thing that is there in that imagination is consciousness, and in fact, that's your experience of it. Okay, so everybody just close your eyes for a minute. I'm going to just do a little guided meditation. As I say these words, I want you to just imagine them, try to have a vivid imagination, and then see whether or not it has any being apart from consciousness at all. So imagine a meadow with trees and sky and sun, walking through the meadow. Imagine a beach with ocean waves. Hear the roar of the waves. Imagine the sun and the clouds. And the hot sand underneath your feet. Imagine an apple tree. With an apple on the ground. Imagine your living room, sitting on the couch or chair. Okay, open your eyes. If you can't get a really solid imagination, you can think of your own daydream or just thought modification, and realize that in that daydream or thought modification or imagination, what is really there? Because the names and forms, sense perception, color, dimension, space, all of those things are there. Right? All of those things are there. But none of them are separate in any way or have any substance apart from your own being. And your own being remains as the very changeless substratum to everything that's going on there. Right? Everything. So, when we do meditative techniques like japa, for instance, one of the reasons japa is so powerful is because it's a technique that helps us to differentiate, make very vivid the differentiation between your own presence, consciousness, just this divya amurtaha of purusha, right? The changeless, conscious, formless being that you are, your own presence, and the thoughts in the mind. Because when you do the japa, you know, the repetition of a mantra, Om Namah Shivaya, 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 you're breaking associative thinking, which allows you everything to slow down, giving you an opportunity to see what the real relationship is between yourself and the thought. Right? Because what you will see is that you, the conscious being that you are, you are the constant. And the thought is just a manifestation that has no being apart from you. So you can say it's a manifestation of knowledge. So Maya is that what we call the akshara, the causal condition, really the upadi, the conditioning agent for the individual and for Brahman, right? That has for its source and for its being yourself, but you don't change. So it's a conditioning agent, right, which manifests knowledge. And that manifestation of knowledge and all kinds of the activity that goes on with that is present to consciousness, illumined by consciousness, and has your very being as its substance. But none of it changes you in any way. So for you, once you recognize yourself as the purusha, right, the consciousness which is not changing, then when this movie is going on, right, which is not anything away from you. There's nothing of it. It's a manifestation of total knowledge, this whole creation. But this manifestation of total knowledge isn't any different in reality, really, than the than the manifestation of knowledge from your own mind. Right? So let me explain that again, because I want you to be able to make this jump. In reference to you as an individual, once we recognize the changelessness of my being, this conscious being that I am, right? And then I recognize these thoughts really are just manifestations of knowledge. All of them are known, right? They're known because of the consciousness, and they're not away from consciousness. So any thought is a manifestation of knowledge. Now, when I recognize that this body and mind and sense organs belong to this creation, right? Then this creation becomes a manifestation of knowledge, in which this body, mind, sense organs are included, right? I'm only used to experiencing the manifestation of knowledge in reference to my own mind. But when I recognize that in reality, this body, mind, sense organs are part of this creation. And this creation is what the Shastra says, this creation itself is a manifestation of knowledge, in which this body, mind, sense organs are included. And that this manifestation of knowledge, total knowledge, is what we call Ishvara. But it is a manifestation of whose knowledge? Purusha. It's a manifestation of the knowledge of who? Of the conscious being. Who is the conscious being? Just because I give this body over to the creation because it belongs to the creation as an object, I'm still the conscious being. If I give over my sense organs to the creation because they're objects and belong to the creation, I'm still the Purusha. If I give over the mind to the creation because it's an object and it belongs to duality, I'm still the Purusha. I'm just giving over to the creation everything that belongs to the creation, which is this body, mind, sense organs, the ahankar, the I thought, everything. Right? I'm still here. But who I am is this divya, the conscious being, that is the me, the conscious being that is a murta. It's without form. It is absolutely full and complete. From the standpoint of this body, it abides within the body. But when we give the body over to the creation, then it abides within the creation. It's not abiding within the body. The body is abiding within the creation, right? The sense organs are abiding within the creation. The mind is abiding within the creation. And the creation is abiding within me. How is the creation abiding within me? As a manifestation of knowledge. A manifestation of whose knowledge? Of my knowledge. What is the method of that manifestation? That's what we call the Maya Upadhi. The Maya Upadhi manifests as creation and goes into manifestation from beginningless time. That Maya has no beginning. It's not anybody decided to make Maya. Maya is, right? But when we say Maya is, do we mean that, oh, Maya has its own existence? No. We say Maya is that apparent conditioning agent, Kalpita Upadhi, of Brahman. We say Kalpita means it has no being of its own, apart from Brahman. What does that mean? It means just like if I ask you, now imagine an apple and withdraw it. Does that imagination or that capacity have a separate self? Is there a separate self performing that act? No. There is one consciousness, there is one conscious being, right, which is the very being, the very substance of that Maya, which is in causal condition, and of that manifest apple, right? So there's nothing else going on there. There's nobody else there. And that Maya goes into unmanifest condition, right? And so what's the reality of the apple? Right, if I imagine an apple and then I pull the apple back, what's the reality of the apple? Well, we'd say it has a dependent reality, has no absolute reality of its own, because it can come and go. And in fact, everything in the creation is like that. Everything in the creation, even if we look at the objects in the creation, they come into being and they go out of being, everything. And on another level, they come into manifestation and go out of manifestation. And so here in this verse, it says, Aksharat parataha paraha, that Divya Purusha, the Purusha, the self that I am, is paraha. It is the adhishtana. It is the reality the very being, the Adishtana, the very being of the Akshara, right? Of Maya, which is itself Akshara. But it's called the Maya Akshara because that causal condition never goes away, right? The universe can project and then go into unmanifest condition. That unmanifest condition, that causal condition, is the Maya. So that Maya itself is superior to the creation because it's the cause of the creation. So the creation projects and goes into causal condition. Projects, goes into causal condition. But what is the self of that? That is the Purusha. That is me. That is my being. That is the conscious being, which when I differentiate myself and I recognize, ah, the self here is not changeless. I'm not contained in anything. I'm not an object. I'm not like a little pea in a pod. You know, like a little drop of consciousness dropped into the body. No. We get to this, my innermost self. We call it innermost only initially. The innermost self. I'm not innermost. I'm not outermost either. I'm neither inside or outside. In fact, everything exists in me. Right? I'm not inside or outside. Because everything exists in me. But how do I recognize that? Well, first I have to give over to the creation everything that can be objectified. Because then all of this body, mind, sense organs becomes part of the whole. Right? So give over your body and mind and sense organs because they're all objects of perception. They're all objectified. So give them over to Ishwara, to the whole. You see that? Like all of you, it's so easy for me to put you all, you know, into the creation. You're obviously all part of the creation. You know, because I see you as part of the creation. Well, you have to put yourself in as part of the creation too. Okay, so now all of us are part of the creation. All sense organs are part of the creation. All minds, all thoughts are part of the creation. Even the I thoughts are all part of the creation. So all of this is Ishwara. All of this is the whole. What about me, the self? The one that illumines all of this. Now I am not inside or outside. Right? Myself is not inside or outside. Because all of this belongs to the creation and myself, which is not objectifiable, is the very conscious being. Right? Which illumines the whole creation. Right? It's the consciousness which the whole creation enjoys. But then from within the creation you say, I'm the conscious being, I'm the conscious being, I'm the conscious being. Those are the upadis talking. Those are the conditioning adjuncts talking. Consciousness is not saying, I'm the little conscious being over here. And consciousness could just talk, it would just say, I'm the whole. I'm all, I'm everything. How can you say I'm everything? That's why I said, have imagination like of a, I was going to say of a temple, that's a nice imagination. Have imagination of a temple, of a field. Are you not everything? But you're more than everything. Because you're there before, during, and after the imagination. But when the imagination is there, it's you. There's nothing apart from you. Nothing in your experience. There's nothing that's not you. Right? But you're more than that because the imagination comes and goes. That's why we give the imagination or the creation the title of mithya. Because it has no absolute being. Right? The being that it enjoys is me, is the self. It has no absolute being of its own. It depends upon the self for its being. That's why this aksharat parataha paraha. The Divya Purusha, the Purusha is Paraha, supreme, the Adishtana, the one that, the very basis, the very cause of the Akshara, right? Of the Maya, which itself is indestructible, right? And is supreme, itself is indestructible and supreme causal to its manifestation. Just like you are supreme or causal, your mind is supreme, causal to its manifestations. That's why I can ask you to think about something and then you'll manifest that. the causal condition, the Maya, you know, is supreme, is higher, of a higher order. But higher than the Maya is Brahman, because there is no manifestation of anything without consciousness. This consciousness, I am the very being of all of this. So then, how to see this? How to see this? Because it's easy for me to see it. It's easy for me to see it, I would think. The relationship between yourself and your mind. Right? Like, through, for instance, we can do these meditative things like japa and imagination and all of that. You know, to differentiate the silence, the stillness of your own being, and then recognize the manifestation of knowledge in reference to that stillness of your being. Right? And then to be able to say, in reference to that imagination, like an imagination of a meadow, I think you can say, I am the whole. Right? If I imagine a meadow, just within the confines of that, I can say, I am the whole. Right? There's nothing here but me. There's nothing here but consciousness. Right? We could see that. So now, can I see that in reference to the universe? So that I can say, I am the whole. No. As a jiva, through your sense organs and the limited mind, because your mind is limited in the sense that your mind's not my mind. Right? So the minds are different. They're limited. Sense organs are limited. And so you can't, as a jiva, have an experience of the infinite upadhi or conditioning adjunct of Ishwara. You can't have an experience of this whole. Like to say, I am the whole. Right? But the experience, the self-experience of as yourself, as consciousness, the conscious being, has nothing to do with space. That Purnatvam, that infinite being, is totally, completely your being. You don't have a partial experience of yourself. The conscious experience, the self-evident consciousness that you are, that is the whole in reference to consciousness. You're not having a little experience of consciousness, and Ishwara has a big experience of consciousness. There's only one experience of consciousness, the self-evident experience of consciousness, because it's free from time and space. It's nothing about being big or small. It's free from dimension. So you're me, when you say me, the conscious being that will say when you're doing japa, and you're seeing the thoughts floating by and whatnot, but that conscious being that is yourself, that is Bhagavan, that's Ishwara. That's the self. There's not a bigger self or a smaller self. Right? There's not a, Ishwara doesn't have some more expanded awareness. Awareness is awareness. It's free from time. So that me is complete and total and whole. There's no more to be had. But in terms of the Maya Upadhi, you cannot have an experience from the standpoint of the jiva, of the infinite upadhi. However, you can recognize that this body, mind, sense organs, perceptions, objects, all of them are in my awareness. None of them are away from my awareness. There's nothing here at all. There is no experience at all that's away from my awareness. The wall's not away from my awareness. The rug, you know, the painting, the table, the chair, this body, my sense organs. I have no experience whatsoever at any time, nor part of any experience that's away from my awareness. Nor can I find anything, any object that has any substantial being away from that non-objectifiable being of myself. And so once I break this dehatma buddhi, this identification with the body, by objectifying the body, recognizing this is one object along with the others, once I stop trying to see awareness through the body or the sense organs or the mind, but recognize that I am the awareness. Right? Instead of trying to recognize, to see awareness through the upadhi, to recognize I am the awareness that illumines everything. The same awareness because of which this body is known is the awareness because of which the wall is known. The awareness because of which the space is known. The awareness because of which the emotions are known. There, and if that's so, there is nothing ever away from awareness. There is no experience at all away from awareness. And so what's to make the experience of this room, or when I look up at the sky, you know, what's to make any experience not me, any less me than I've imagined a meadow in my mind? What really is the difference? The difference only is this, is that you have some control over the imagination of the meadow. You can make the meadow come and go. You can't make this creation come and go because it's not the imagination of this body, mind, sense organs. And since you can't make it come and go like you can a meadow, you know, you think it has more reality or that somehow it is more removed from your self experience than the meadow, the imaginary meadow. And what I'm saying is that it's not more removed from your experience than the imaginary meadow. Because just as that painting is in my awareness, the space is in my awareness, the body is in my awareness, every experience I have is in my awareness, right? It's only this Dehatma Buddhi that is so strong that makes me only go back to this loop of thinking, well, yeah, but I'm seeing it through my eyes. I'm seeing this through my eyes. And so then awareness gets located in the body. It's a loop, right? But that's not really what's happening. Really what's happening is through the sense organs, right? Your mind, through the sense organs, your mind sees this room. It sees the body. It experiences the body, right? So that you get a thought modification in your mind, right? Which is pervaded by awareness. That's what's happening. Do you see that? This physical, your perception of the physical body, along with the space and everything in this room, it's really just a thought modification in your mind, which is pervaded by awareness. Right? And there's nothing in it that's away from awareness at all. So awareness and the awareness, there's no distance between awareness and the painting, and awareness in the rug, and awareness in the body, and awareness in anything else. So I need to be able to recognize that. And I can do that by this just continuing to recognize that all of this is an object of my awareness. That's why this Drishya Viveka is so important. This body is an object of my awareness. My sense organs are an object. My mind is an object of my awareness. What does that all mean? It all means it all belongs to the creation, like everything else. If it belongs to the creation, then the consciousness which I am is not contained. All of this belongs to the creation through my sense perception. This body belongs to the creation through my sense perception. My sense organs belong to the creation through my sense perception, through the cognition of the mind. The mind itself is known. All of this belongs to the creation, right? If all of it belongs to the creation, then the awareness, the conscious being that I am, is not contained by these objects. Well, how would it be contained? What's going to hook it? What's hooking it? Nothing. And then you think, well, in my experience at this moment, is there anything separate from my awareness? And there isn't. There's nothing separate from your awareness. So you have to walk around talking to yourself like that. Okay, we'll see more next week. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Avyakta.
Would that be the Himalayagarbha part of it?
No, the avyakta would just be like the Ishvara. The avyakta, well, we use the word avyakta actually for unmanifest. Hiranyagarbha is when, in reference to Ishvara, would be like the mind, when the mind is manifest. So the avyakta, say the manifestation comes out of the avyakta. Okay, so say you have your mind and it's not thinking, and then I ask you to think of a pear or something. Okay, in that, when it's performing the function of thinking, of coming into subtle manifestation, that would be Hiranyagarbha. In the avyakta state, that's just Ishvara, where that maya capacity is there.
So where's the
virat? Virat, in reference to the creation, would, for us it would be the waking state. For Bhagavan, it would be the universe that's perceived through the waking state. And Hiranyagarbha would be the laws for the subtle. Even though, you know, only when you're within the creation you can make these distinctions between Virat and Hiranyagarbha. But really, from the standpoint of Ishvara, it's just like one infinite manifestation of knowledge. But within the whole time-space dimension and then the jiva, there's a subtle and a physical. So the Ishvara being perceived through the sense perception, we call Virat. But if we're not being perceived through the sense perception, then it's that subtle realm that we call Hiranyagarbha. And also Hiranyagarbha is that projection, that the manifestation of the creation with all of the five elements that have not gone through the Panchakarana. Right, to become physicalized. So that's what that is. That's why they make that distinction. Because, but those distinctions are within the creation where you're seeing, you have all this multidimensional stuff going on, you know, from within the creation. From the standpoint of Ishvara, the whole thing is known. It's a manifestation of knowledge. But from within that which is known, there's all this multidimension, you know, and space, time and space, and subtle and gross. And
so would be space and time would be part, would be
Hiranyagarbha and Virat. Because just like in your mind, if you have an imagination, that has dimension on a subtle level. Right? If you have a dream or a daydream, there's on a subtle level space, air, fire, water, earth. Right? There's dimension. It has its own time. It has its own dimension. It has its own change, its own activity. So space is both subtle and physical. And the elements also are subtle. And then they also can go through this process of becoming physical, which we call Panchakarana, fivefold.
Can the knowledge that, like, all of this as consciousness, can that only be seen because consciousness pervades the mind? You know, I don't know if that's, if I said enough there. But it's like I can see in an imagination, a dream, all of that is me. And I can see that because it just clearly is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then with like the creation, the way I have knowledge of the creation is through my sense organs, right? And in the end, it's
right.
thought,
mm-hmm.
which is pervaded by consciousness.
Right.
So, granted, it's not solipsism. I mean, I know the creation is here.
Right.
So, but the only way that I know that it's pervaded by consciousness is just because in that thought, consciousness pervades the thought?
Well, there's another level there. When you go to analyze this creation that you're experiencing through your sense organs, so we know this creation is here because we have sense organs in our mind, and we know that we're not projecting it. So this, let's put it this way, this creation that we experience through our sense perception, whatever you want to say about it, it's here, experienced through our sense perception. When we analyze it, we find it has no being. Because everything in the creation is bound by change. That's one thing. If it's bound by change, that means it's bordered by non-existence. It's prior condition, it wasn't there. Posterior condition, it's not there. Okay. Also, every object is infinitely divisible. So now with these two logics, what we experience is, if we really look into this particular logic, that in the, say, the breaking up of an object into infinitely smaller parts, for instance, the one thing that remains constant is the being of whatever object is there. That we can never break up. Okay? And it doesn't matter what object it is. If I go from breaking up this object and get rid of the whole object completely, being has not gone, and move over to this object, being never goes. So what we recognize is, though, being itself is the noun. Being is what is actually here.
And whether the object is sentient or insentient, this is true.
It makes any no difference whatsoever.
Right.
And but then we go from there, okay, no matter whether something comes into being or goes out of being, being doesn't come or go. Now, where is this being, right? The being is not something that we can objectify. You can't look at it, you know. But you can only be it. You are that being. There's no objective experience of being. But when we analyze all these objects, all of which we give being to, like we say, like this chair exists and this exists, we give being, that's existence, to all of these things. But when you go and try to find something solid, you can't find anything, but you cannot touch the being that this whole creation enjoys. Because the being that it creates, that the creation enjoys, is non-objectifiable. That's the Purusha. That's yourself. In fact, we think that there are words like I am and you are and it is. So we could be able to, well, this is. But there's no experience of is. Right? There's experience of objects, but there's the experience of is the experience of am. There's no experience of you are. Is, am, and are three words that are just referring to the amness, the beingness of me, the non-objectifiable being, right? And that is its own experience. And that experience, who does that belong to? It doesn't belong to this body. This body comes and goes. Doesn't belong to the mind. The mind changes. Doesn't belong to the sense organs. They come and go. Doesn't belong to the objects in the world. They're infinitely divisible, changing, right? And so this being, and the being doesn't belong to me either. I am that. If you say it belongs to, but doesn't belong to somebody, it's who I am, right? I am that. That's why nobody can do anything about me. I can't do anything about me.
But everything else is that also. I mean, everything is that.
Everything is that. Yeah. But because that's non-objectifiable, right, you can't look at it. But nothing is away from it. That's why you can understand it if you have like an imagination of a meadow, for instance. You are that, you're very clear, and nothing is away from it. But now, when we realize, well, what about these things out here? You know, do these things have some being of their own? But when you analyze these objects here, you can't find an object. That's why it's so important to understand that this empirical reality, right, that you're not creating with your mind. Your sense organs are perceiving it, right? It's not your own solipsism. It's not your own creation. Let's look at any given object in the creation. You're only calling it an object. It's really just a name for a conglomerate of things. Like this, you call this a lamp. But it's really not. It's metal and paint and wiring and all kinds of different things put together. And this conglomerate gets the name lamp. But it can be dissected further into, you know, molecules and atoms and quarks and on and on and on and on. You can't find anything. But no matter what you're separating it into and dividing it into, that thing is. There will always be that. The isness will always be there. The being will always be there. But the being isn't something you're looking at. You don't say, oh, look at the being. But you project being onto all of this, but the being that you're projecting is just your own self-experience.
So this what we see here, then, is like an imagination of Ishwara, in a way?
Yeah.
That's Ishwara's imagination, what we see here.
Yeah. That's one way of saying it. It's just, as long as you don't make it too ephemeral. Like, for instance, when you think humanly of an imagination, you hold it for a few seconds and it goes. This is much sturdier than that. Mm. You know?
Yeah, because I haven't created it.
Yeah.
Right. And what do you mean by
But in terms of the non-dual substance of it, you know, to understand also, like if you have a dream and you're a character within the dream, witnessing the dream from the eyes of the character within the dream. It's substantial. That dream is not that character's imagination, right? It's the imagination of the dreamer. And it's still all Maya. It's nothing but you. But from the standpoint of the character within the dream, right, they didn't imagine the dream. They're part of the dream. Right? And they experience that dream from within the dream, and they knock on the chair, and this has weight, and all of these things apply. All of the laws that, you know, that go with that make up the dream universe. Right? But that doesn't mean that it's not all a manifestation of knowledge and pure consciousness. You see what I'm saying? This is all just a manifestation of pure consciousness, of knowledge. There's nothing here apart from that. But that doesn't mean that there's not empirical reality. It has empirical reality.
As though.
No, really. It's not even as though. It really has empirical reality. But this empirical reality is mitya. This empirical reality has its being as just pure consciousness. The reality of empirical reality is pure consciousness. If you can say the reality of the dream is pure consciousness, the dream has its own empirical reality within itself, right?
Yeah, so it's clear with the imagination.
The imagination is pure is a manifestation of knowledge. It's pure consciousness. If you held that imagination, there's somebody within the imagination doing something. They are within the imagination. They didn't imagine it. They're within the imagination. And they're experiencing the empirical reality of the internal workings of the imagination, since they didn't create it, right? But that whole imagination is nothing but consciousness.
Right.
Yeah. And so here, all of this is nothing but consciousness. That's all it is. It's just consciousness. But this consciousness has empirical, this manifestation has empirical reality.
But when you say nothing's away from consciousness, there's a little bit, I have a little problem with that because it seems to me like it's separating it. Like nothing is away from consciousness, but it's my understanding that actually everything is consciousness. Not
yeah, you asked, you said this last time. Well, we can say it that way. We can say it that way, but sometimes if you say nothing is away from consciousness, the emphasis that's being put when you say it like that can say everything is consciousness, but then I also want to differentiate the changeless from the changing. Right? So if I say everything is consciousness, but consciousness never changes, then this changes. Right?
Yeah. And then you have to bring in Maya to explain.
Yeah. But still, even though this is continually changing, it's not away from consciousness, it is consciousness. So I can say, you know, you have to keep working with the words to recognize that the conscious being of all of this is changeless. It yourself isn't changing. Right? I said, if I say, use a word like if I have a thought, the thought is, and even there's dimension within the thought, but nothing in the thought is away from consciousness. So, like if I say it's obvious that this body is conscious, but if I say that that is nothing but consciousness also, that I say it's not away from consciousness, then I'm trying to show that all of this is nothing but consciousness. So,
I was just going to say that, you know, because the way you explain it tonight, it seems quite, in a certain way, obvious, you know, this point of that everything is a manifestation of Ishvara, the whole changing, you know, all Nitya and everything, but that Ishvara undergoes no modification. But I know that this is considered like one of the big...
Atman doesn't go under any amount of...
Or Atman doesn't undergo...
Purusha,
Brahman doesn't go under any...
Modification.
Modification, even though it is the cause of the creation, which is only everything, but which is always which is all change.
Yeah.
And but I know that this is considered to be like one of the most difficult stumbling blocks in understanding this teaching. I mean, like Christians and everything, they try to deal with this issue by creating an acosmic God who creates everything out of nothing because it's fundamental that God doesn't change. But anyways, I'm just saying that somehow the way you explain it today, it seems like quite simple and obvious.
It's simple and obvious.
Yeah.
And the
that's
thing
the
is,
problem.
Yeah, that's one of the problems. But you know, one of the things that is so beautiful is to realize that we have this Maya. As a jiva, you have this Maya. You have projecting a snake on a rope. You have dream. You have fantasy. You have imagination. You have thoughts. All of these things are tools that for you to recognize the relationship between the changeless and the changing, between the self, between consciousness, and the manifestation of knowledge. So there's plenty of drishtantas, illustrations, so that when the shastra is unfolding Ishvara, we can use these illustrations, especially like dream and imagination, to make you really see what it is. So you have first-hand experience of it, actually.
This thing about between the kalpas, that there's some remainder. Is this like...
What do you mean?
I don't know. I read something there's like shesh, or there's the remainder.
The what?
A remainder between... After a dissolution or laya.
You know...
Is that... I mean, I'm just wondering if this is the same as when you were talking about the causal...
Between the creation, there's... The creation goes into a vyakta, which is a causal condition.
Into the causal
condition. Causal condition, and then it will project again.
So everything stays... Is still. There's still the knowledge of everything.
Yes.
In the causal state, like as a potential.
That's right.
And then through the power of Maya, through the...
Maya itself goes into objecta, this unmanifest condition, and that's just unmanifest knowledge. Infinite, all knowledge, right, is in unmanifest condition. And then when the creation projects, yeah, Big Bang or whatever, then that's the manifestation of knowledge. Yeah. But you can see what's so interesting is to see that in your own mind, the difference between that, how much knowledge is sitting there right now, unmanifest. Mm-hmm. You know, and then when it comes into manifestation, then it's taken form. That's the nama-rupa. But in that process of manifesting and going into unmanifest condition, nothing happens to you, to consciousness. Consciousness just remains exactly the same. So like that, for you, there's never, ever has been or ever will be any type of modification whatsoever. You're the constant being, you know, of the entire creation, actually. Right? But, which is fine. but the biggest thing about that is that it's you, that yourself is changed. Yourself is the very changeless substance of all of this.
That's what's great about that Krishna-tanta that you're using, imagination, because awareness is, and then in the causal state you imagine something, and it dissolves, and so awareness is.
Yeah. And nothing happens to awareness if they're before, during, and after. And if you recognize just your day-to-day experience, moment-to-moment-to-moment experience, this is what it is. You are always there, always exactly the same, and all of this stuff is going on. All of your thoughts, all of your moods, all of your emotions, all of your aches and pains, all of this just continues to go on. But you are not going on. You are the constant presence. And all of this is taking place in you. Nothing's happening to you. And you are benign. Right? Your being is benign. So when the mind recognizes that, then it has a home that it can rest in.
So on a certain level of this is dependent on a evolved mind. This knowledge is dependent. Because if you gave this knowledge, taught this teaching to a young child, for example, It wouldn't be able to really.
Well, it would have to be kind of an unusual child, like a little prodigy or something.
But what I'm saying is that, you know, I'm not saying that's. I guess what I'm saying is that the mind, the paradox is that a mind that's cognizant is what allows for this teaching to be known.
And it's your mind that has the problem.
Right.
Brahman doesn't have any problem. The self doesn't have any problem. The self is happily, as it is, changelessly illumining the ignorant, suffering mind. And it's also just quietly, as it is, illumining the jnani mind also. But the mind is the one that gets into these problems of pain, right? So the mind's the one that needs to be released from that. And the mind that's going to be released is the mind that has recognized there's a problem. Because in samsara, for lifetimes, you go on thinking, well, if I could just do this or tweak this a little bit or this, you know, I can make it better. I can make things work out. I can make things happen. I can make myself become whole and complete and happy. And at some point, you become a mumukshu and you realize, uh-oh, that is not a possibility. Right, and that's when the Upanishads are valuable then. What?
Well, I was just going to say, the word abhayam is used a lot.
Abhayam.
Abhayam. Fearless, right? So is the fearlessness, is it sort of twofold in that I realize myself is changeless, ever-present, can't be touched, it's who I really am. So I know that must be part of it. But then I always thought the other part was the understanding. And all of this creation is me. Is it?
In one of the Upanishads, there's a few lines that say basically, even the slightest whiff of duality creates fear. So the abhayam means without fear. That fearlessness is the recognition that I am the whole. There's no second thing here. Yeah.
So, in terms of this, the stories of my life, the things that happened to me,
yeah,
or, and all, as fleeting an experience as all those are, is that, are those experiences, is that a manifestation of being?
Yeah, those experiences belong to the jiva, this transmigrating entity. And it's the manifestation of karmas that are being exhausted within the whole bigger picture. So within the whole picture of as a manifestation of Ishvara, that's gone on for thousands upon thousands upon thousands of years, this manifestation, you as an individual within this creation are also beginningless and come creation after creation and creation, and are living out lifetime after lifetime after lifetime based upon your karmas. Right, and so those karmas are manifesting according as appropriate to the total karmas. As part of the total karmas, the appropriate karmas that are yours will manifest to make you take this particular birth at this time, you know, and exhaust karmas throughout this life like that.
So this particular jiva's experience, is there any beingness in terms of, is there any truthfulness to them? If I look at beingness as there, truthfulness?
Yeah, I would put like this. There's two levels of truthfulness. One is the absolute being, which is changeless. And so that's yourself. When you say, I am the consciousness. So that consciousness is the pervasive substance of all that is. Like the water is the pervasive substance of the ocean and all the waves. The empirical, the body, your body, mind, sense organs, and the jiva that's transmigrating, life after life after life, that is part of Maya. And that enjoys an empirical reality. Mm-hmm. Right? That's based upon the karmas that are exhausting. Right?
But for me to kind of live that distinction between those two realities, isn't that making a duality out of it and kind of making a lot of juxtaposition?
Well, yeah, that's why in this teaching, that's why we have to recognize the distinction between what we call satyam, or that absolute reality, and mitya. So when you recognize that the one has no being apart from the other. So if you were to say you imagine a creation, you close your eyes and you imagine a creation. That creation has no substance apart from yourself. There's only one whole there. But within this creation that's imagined, there's a lot of activity and things going on. But nevertheless, they're not separate from yourself. Another way to look at it, if we use the example of the ocean, which has so many waves, you know, one huge, massive body of water with many, many, many waves all interacting with one another. So on that level, there's all this duality, all of this activity going on that has an empirical reality, right? But the substance is just water, right? So that's the truth of it all. But this empirical reality has its own laws and own, you know, order to it. But these laws and order and the names and forms of all of the waves have no beings apart from the water. So like that, this whole creation, it has all of its order, all of these laws, all of these things going on, all of the jivas transmigrating on a whole panorama, very complex, you know. But all of this complexity has only one being, one substance. And that's why Advaita, that's why non-dual. And that one substance, which is the truth of all of it, is my own being, the consciousness.
That's good. Thank you. Very well explained.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And just one other question. So from the perspective of the jiva, you know, I've just thought about it a lot. And at the end of all of it, is there any free will? I mean, aren't I ultimately just like a kaleidoscope, the whole jiva experience is unfolding, and I mean, I experience free will, but am I really doing the free will?
The The Shastra acknowledges free will, but what it says that yes, there is free will because you're responsible within this whole kaleidoscope or the whole world of activity. You are responsible for your actions, so your actions can produce punya and papa. So there's free will, but it also acknowledges that you can't tease out the prarabdha karma, the karmas that caused you to take this birth. You can't separate those karmas that are happening right now from the free will that is happening right now. Right? So they're extremely interrelated. You can't tease it out. You know, so even though there's free will, the free will is very much mingled with the prarabdha karma and influenced by.
It almost sounds like there's some ultimate compassion saying, yeah, you have free will, but you really don't. But
Well, no, actually, it doesn't say that.
It
doesn't want to say that either, because also, if there's no free will, just from the whole vision of the Upanishads, if you were to totally remove free will, then there's no justice in terms of karma. You know, to account for why you're having this particular set of experiences and so-and-so is having this particular set of experiences. So they really do are serious when they say that the choices that you make will cause certain results. But they also say that, of course, every choice you make is a choice that's being made within the situation of your free will, of the karma that brought you here. However, they have to say free will, or otherwise there would be no equality,
no
justice.
You have some choice, but it's limited by your
condition. That's right. I mean, just think of it. You were born in this era with your parents in a particular place, in a particular situation. And that limits, right? That right there, that's going to limit the choices. But within the major thread of of your karma, then there's a lot of choice. It would be hard to go outside of kind of the boundaries of your prarabdha.
But it gets so hard to figure out because you also come with all these tendencies and your knowledge of what even choices you might even think to make are determined by your karma.
That's right.
It's very hard to figure out where the actual choice comes in.
That's right.
That's right.
You can't tease it out. But just because you can't tease it out, to then say you have no free will is a jump that the Upanishads won't accept. And also in your own experience, you don't accept that either. You
have to act like you have free will, right? I mean, you have to.
Well, I would even say differently. You experience yourself as having free will.
Mm-hmm.
So your mind can go on a trip, but what it would have to say is, well, even though I experience that I have free will and that I'm responsible for my actions, and in fact I really don't, and we're all just automatons, you're actually making that up. It's not based upon your experience at all. And it's not going to be something supported by the Shastra.
Well, you know, it's so funny because so many of the verses, this was very puzzling to me, say something like, it's, you know, you think that you're the doer, but you aren't. You know, you think you're the body, mind, sense organs, you think you're the doer.
But that's taking you to the Atma, right? The Atma is not the doer.
Right.
Right.
But then
from once you're in empirical reality, right?
Yeah.
And there's the body, mind, sense organs,
uh-huh.
right, that are a manifestation of knowledge that have certain capacities.
Right.
Just like if you say, okay, this universe, it has certain laws that allow it to function and allow us to function within it. The body has certain laws,
mm-hmm.
you know, that allow me to go like this, right? I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
I can think.
Mm-hmm.
I can see. These are capacities that this upadhi has,
mm-hmm.
right? But that doesn't mean it's not maya,
mm-hmm.
right? Or it doesn't also mean that it's not nothing, that the truth of it all is being, is consciousness. But this upadhi is able to think, is able to make decisions, is able to choose.
Well, let me say, Gyani's eye lands on Brahman, you know, then then there's still the doing and the activity. And so then what, at that point, what is it? Ishwara is just acting. It's just the Maya moving. I mean, I always sort of wonder about that.
Well, that's why there's that verse in the Bhagavad Gita, as though thinking, as though thinking, as though seeing, as though sleeping, as though standing. Because for a person who has self-knowledge, you've differentiated the constancy of your own that is really the whole, you know, from the total identification with the upadi. But from the standpoint of the upadi, you know, it is enjoying consciousness. It's just that the consciousness is not dependent on the upadi. The upadi is totally dependent on the consciousness. The consciousness is not dependent on the mind. The mind is totally dependent on consciousness. Right? Without consciousness, it's just not even there. It's like pulling the rope out from the snake, you know. It's totally dependent. So this mind, for its being, is totally dependent on consciousness. The consciousness is not dependent on it at all. But now you say, well, okay, this mind that is totally dependent on consciousness, it thinks, it feels, it makes choices. That's part of the expression of Ishwara. That's a capacity of Ishwara for all of the jivas. And then there's a whole array. Like the human being has the capacity to think and to feel and to self-reflect, and maybe the flower has the capacity just to kind of sense and feel. You know, but they have all, depending upon the laws and the structure of that particular manifestation, it can do different things within the whole.
But really, it's all just Ishwara acting.
Yeah. 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 In that sense, there's nothing away from Ishwara. But then, as a jiva, which is part of Ishwara, right, there's a capacity, you have certain capacities, and one is free choice. Even though that free will is very much integrated with all of the karmas and all of the surroundings, you know, it's still there. And you experience it as being there, too.
I'm just thinking, you know, you have free will, and you have your punya and your papa, but it's only within the time space that this manifestation that you would say that punya takes you to closer to
heaven worlds or happy
results. And papa takes you away. There's nothing but. So that's where I kind of.
That punya and papa, that's all within the creation.
Right.
And the jiva, the transmigration of the jiva. That's all within the creation. Brahman, yourself, the Purusha, is not transmigrating, not changing at all. There's no punya and papa for the self. There's no free will for the self. There's just consciousness, just you, just simple, the pure being of yourself that is constant and always there. It's not, you know, it's not having to, it's not that they have free will, so you don't have to worry. You're not going to become worse. You're not going to become better. You're just the infinite conscious being that you are. So for you, there's no transmigration or anything. Transmigration is all belonging to the jiva, the conditioning agent.
So, right? So would the jnani then see, like, for the jnani's body, mind, sense organs, would they really completely know that's Ishwara? You know, that's Ishwara. They would know, I am Brahman, and the body, mind, sense organs, Ishwara.
Yeah, Ishwara. Yeah. And so you'd look, no, this is all part of Ishwara.
Right.
This is all Ishwara.
Right.
And this is part of Ishwara.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's what you know.
Just backtracking a little bit, I have a question about seeing this reality, like, because what this verse actually was really key for me tonight, that you said something different than you've ever said before in some way. About the superior status of unmanifest Maya, you know, and that it always exists on some level. But what I find is that my mind can't grasp that. I mean, it can't get beyond duality, my mind. I can't grasp that reality with my mind, even though you can break down reality into two different categories to account for the two different orders of reality, but then say they're really just one. It's just a paradox for my mind. But I can only see it. Like, I can see the truth of it through the example and just through seeing it directly. Is that right? I mean, is that how it is? Because my mind just gets stuck trying to figure it out.
Well, I'm not quite sure what I said that is... Let's see what I said that is different here. Now, Maya, as when it's referred to as Akshara, which doesn't usually, Maya is not usually referred to as Akshara, so that's unique. So, but when it's referred to as Akshara, what does it mean? It means that the Maya itself doesn't change, it doesn't go away. That's why the Akshara Parataha, that Akshara is itself supreme from its own manifestation. That means the Maya as avyakta, as unmanifest, is there. It manifests, it goes into unmanifest. It manifests, it goes into unmanifest. So that Akshara is supreme, superior to the manifest Maya. The unmanifest Maya is superior to the manifest Maya. And now that unmanifest Maya, the Brahman is superior to that, because Brahman is the self of it, the being of it. So that's the vision that's being given there in that Upanishad. Now, you tell me what was the confusing part there.
Well, the thing that my mind can't wrap around is the fact that there's only one thing, but yet there's two things. You know, like the
Maya
is separated from Brahman, because it is separate, I can see that.
Well, the problem is, this is maybe paradoxical, because you can't say that it's separate,
right,
because there is nothing else but Brahman. So there's no place else for Maya to be. It's like, not like there's Brahman, and then there's over here on this corner, we'll have some Maya. So there's no way for it to be separate, right?
Right.
But, so it can't be away from Brahman, so Brahman has to be what we call the Adhishtana. So just by Adhishtana, just like the snake can't be aware from the rope. Right, you can't say where can you put the snake?
Mm-hmm.
Do you say it's resting on top of the rope? It's not.
Yeah.
You can't say it's away from the rope. You can't say it's in the rope. But it's a phenomenon. That's the phenomena of Maya,
mm-hmm.
Right? So you would have to say that it's mitya. And what does mitya mean? It means that it is there, but it has no being apart from Brahman. So that's the paradox.
Yeah.
It's not away from us. You can't say separate from as though there's any space in between.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. It's a paradox.
It is. I guess, but you have to understand that once you understand the paradox, it's not so much of a paradox, right?
It's a seeming duality.
Well, you can say it is a seeming duality. It's an as-though duality.
Right.
Right. But when you say something's an as-though duality, as soon as you say as-though, there's no duality there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we say this is as-though duality, because there's nothing here but duality. But to be able to say this is an as-though duality, or that you have to say it's mitya. Once you say it's mitya, what that means is everything that you perceive here, all of these names and forms, are totally dependent for their being on something else. Right? That's what mitya means. And so, like Swamiji's used the example before, like the shirt. I think just recently, the shirt is totally dependent on the cloth for its being. That's mitya. So like that, this jagat, this whole creation, is maya, which has maya for its cause of the manifestation. The whole thing is totally dependent for its being on Brahman. You know, that's the Adhishtana. So when you say it's as though duality, that what you mean, what you have to bring in is the word mitya then. It's dependent reality. And we have plenty of examples of mitya in the world. Rope snake is one, dream is one, clay pot is one, a shirt, cloth shirt, gold chain. Wave ocean. These are all examples of what we mean by mitya, where there is something that you're experiencing that has no independent being apart from something else. And that's how you can get to Advaita. So that's what this Maya is. It's mitya.
So, but would you say, though, that when you get the paradox, then you get it? But my experience is that when I get the paradox resolves into reality itself, seeing it directly, not the mind, it's not the mind, it's like the paradox twists just like a poem, you know, it twists you out of duality in a way.
Yeah, because there is no duality.
But yeah.
It takes you out of duality to recognize this is just Brahman. That's exactly right. But just as, like, if you're looking at the ocean, you can see, oh, this is only water. That's all you see is the water. But you see the water and the ocean and the waves at the same time, you see this is only water. So there's no problem there. There's no, oh, there's water and there's waves and there's ocean. How am I going to put all this through together? You know? And then you just see, oh, yeah, this is all awareness. That's right.
Just as an educational question, because I know this, I think I know how, because many people follow Buddhism, and they, in the Buddhist texts or in the Buddhist teachings, they refer to this as not real. Is it similar? You know, as people making a mistake with Vedanta, where what they really mean is that it's dependent on something else, or do they actually mean that this existence that you think is all just part of your imagination?
I don't really think Buddhism says it like that. I think that students or people who don't know what they're talking about say it like that.
Okay.
All right, should we start there? Okay.
I hope the recording.